Beaufort Sea polar bears have hair loss and skin lesions.
The fact that it's occurring at the same time of this unexplained mortality event with seals certainly raises the interest level.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 6th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the oil industry weighs in on the Senate's oil tax plan.
And with any tax increase, it's going to force us to reevaluate our existing activity plans.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Association of Alaska School Boards believes that all students should be proficient in reading, writing, and math by the time they finish the third grade. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
Biologists have found polar bears in the Beaufort Sea with hair loss and skin lesions. Those are the same symptoms that have sickened ice seals and walruses in the Arctic since last summer and have led the federal government to declare the incident an unusual mortality event. Scientists are just beginning an investigation into whether polar bears are suffering from the same thing. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
United States Geological Survey scientists began their yearly polar bear field work in the southern Beaufort Sea in mid-March, and it wasn't long before they started capturing bears with hair loss and skin lesions. Tony DeGange is chief of the biology office for USGS in Alaska.
The first day we observed it was on March 21st, and we had three captures, and two of them had alopecia, which is the skin loss. And so it was like, wow, that's interesting. Then we started picking it up on other animals in later March. And it's like, okay, this is more than normal.
So far, the field scientists have found hair loss on 9 of the 33 bears they've captured. The bears have skin lesions on their head, neck, and ears. DeGange says they've found polar bears with similar symptoms since 1999, but the number of the affected bears makes this year unusual.
The bears appear to be healthy otherwise. So we haven't seen any dead bears, so there's not it's not a mortality event as far as we know. But the fact that it's occurring at the same time of this unexplained mortality event with seals certainly raises the interest level.
The biologists collected blood and tissues from the affected bears to try to figure out if the symptoms are related to the mysterious illness that has been found in ice seals and walruses. Dozens of seals have died from the disease, but no walrus deaths are attributed to it. Scientists don't yet know if the walrus and seals are suffering from the same thing, although the veterinary pathologist who has done most of the necropsies on the animals say the lesions look very similar under the microscope. Julie Spiegel is a spokesperson for the National Marine Fisheries Service. She says it's been a difficult case.
We still don't know what is causing the disease, but our scientists have ruled out a number of bacteria and viruses that are known to affect marine mammals.
Spiegel says the latest tests to turn up negative were for two toxins that can cause harmful algae blooms.
So just a couple more possible causes of illness that we have ruled out, and we continue to go forward with studying samples and trying to find out what is causing this disease.
Polar bears will not be included as part of the unusual mortality event until there's a lot more evidence linking the illnesses. Polar bears were listed as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act in 2008, but Tony DeGange with USGS says the agency would put a high priority on understanding what's causing the symptoms with or without the listing.
Polar bears are an iconic species in the Arctic. They're a subsistence resource to the natives on the North Slope, and I don't think we're giving them any more special attention because they're listed than otherwise.
DeGange says out of four polar bears biologists captured Thursday, three had skin lesions and hair loss. The crew is now moving farther west along the Beaufort Sea coast near Prudhoe Bay, so they'll have a chance to see if the illness is as widespread in that area. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The oil industry today was very critical of the Senate's rewrite of the state's oil tax regime. The bill now in the Finance Committee makes a structural change to the current profit-based tax system, replacing it with a tax on the oil's gross value. Studies by the committee show that the new tax is a reduction from the current plan, although it is not as industry-friendly as the bill introduced by the governor last year. However, BP's head of finance, Damian Bilbao, told the committee that in his company's view, it's a tax increase.
Senate Bill 192, in our opinion, and as shown by your own consultant, within the price range that we look at our business and our projects, is a tax increase. And with any tax increase, it's going to force us to reevaluate our existing activity plans. And just like it's a tax increase, that means it's not a meaningful change, and it's not going to lead to additional investment.
So far this session and last, lawmakers have been unsuccessful in getting the oil companies and their supporters, including the Parnell administration, to give a clear definition of meaningful change. Responding to committee questions, Bilbao explained the term.
Achieving a level of meaningful tax change would, in fact, return money that otherwise would be going into the state back to the producers that would invest that money, as we've said before, incremental to what we're already investing. Whatever that number is exactly, we can look at it in more detail, but I think fundamentally what you're asking is the magnitude of the reduction, and yes, sir, it would be a magnitude, and I think what I've seen is that $100 is about $1 billion.
In return for the $1 billion more in tax cuts, he said the state could look at an additional $20 billion of investment. The committee also heard similar arguments from Revenue Commissioner Brian Butcher. In describing his view of the changes, Butcher predicted the new tax would not help the state. Co-chair Bert Stedman, a Republican from Sitka, asked Butcher how he could define a tax drop from 90% to 40% as, quote, barely measurable.
I would just remind you that we've been in this game for several years, and to be careful what you tell us, because if you tell us that significant change is inconsequential, as you can see, we have members here that start, think it's humorous. So let's try to be a little accurate in our discussion.
House Speaker Mike Chenault says it's highly likely lawmakers won't finish their work and get out of Juneau by the legislature's scheduled adjournment date of April 15th. The House has yet to see an oil tax bill. Chenault says he's not going to force his committee chairs to complete their work by April 15th. Anchorage Assembly Chair Debbie Osiander says it's too early to appoint an outside investigator to look into the Anchorage ballot debacle. The ACLU of Alaska made the request for an outside investigator on Thursday after widespread ballot shortages reports that voters were turned away at the polls during Tuesday's municipal election. Osiander says the clerk's office and the Election Commission should be allowed to do their work.
It seems to me premature to bring in any kind of an outside investigator when the body that is supposed to do the work hasn't completed their work yet.
The Election Commission is made up of 6 people appointed by the mayor to oversee the election. Although the Assembly is waiting to take up the matter, Osiander says she's already gathering information to help the Assembly decide what to do.
I've asked the municipal attorney to investigate what are the implications for an election if people are denied the ability to vote. I wanted him to tell me what it takes to trigger requiring an election to be thrown out and a new election to occur. So he's been working on that. I have another discussion with both the municipal attorney and the assembly attorney to try to understand what are the parameters for that allow the assembly to call a special election.
The ACLU of Alaska has not commented on the commission, but it says the clerk should not be involved in the investigation and says since the municipal attorney serves at the pleasure of the mayor, he also should not be involved. The matter will go before the assembly once the clerk's office and commission finish their reports. Osiander says it's unlikely that will be by Tuesday's regular assembly meeting and says she could call a special meeting to address the issue. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, birds begin their spring migration to Alaska.
The raging story around here has been the goose who's been hanging out with the sandhill crane.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Governor Sherrod Parnell's pick for the Alaska Public Offices Commission pulled his name from consideration yesterday because of disparaging remarks he had previously made about Alaska Natives. David Eichler, a dentist from North Pole and former head of the Alaska Dental Society, came under fire after comments he made during a legal dispute in 2006 were published online. Eichler suggested that higher rates of tooth decay in rural Alaska were the result of cultural deficiencies and that tooth decay was a form of child abuse in Native communities. He wrote that, quote, any culture that allows such disease will soon disappear, and rightfully so. Eichler also argued for the end of federal health subsidies in bush communities because it was preventing Alaska Natives from assimilating into American society. Representative Bryce Edgman of Dillingham says that he and other rural legislators received a number of complaints about the nomination from their constituents.
I heard everything from outrage to anger to concern to displeasure and, you know, all the usual reactions that you might expect to receive given the nature of the comments that that were made.
Eichler was scheduled to appear before the Senate State Affairs Committee yesterday morning, but withdrew his name from consideration for APOC's Republican seat after multiple Native organizations had criticized the nomination. The Alaska Public Offices Commission is a bipartisan board that reviews campaign finances and administers Alaska's disclosure laws. An oil tanker docked in icy waters at Nikiski had what investigators are calling a near miss when it was accidentally set adrift while loading oil from the Tesoro tank farm. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports on the January incident, which came to light last week following the release of an internal Tesoro investigation.
The incident happened in the early morning hours of January 13th at the Kenai Pipeline Dock in Nikiski, where the oil tanker Overseas Martinez was moored. According to an internal investigation conducted by Tesoro Corporation, the Martinez was loading oil when crew members noticed a buildup of ice around the ship. At about 6 o'clock in the morning, the ice had built up enough to create pressure on the ship's mooring lines, enough pressure that crewmen requested assistance from the Crowley Tug Vigilant, which was positioned nearby. At 6:24 a.m., the Tug Vigilant lost power to both of its engines and was set adrift. When the line between the two ships soon became taut, the force of the shock caused approximately 40 feet of the Martinez's railing to be ripped from the deck. The weight of the tug and the four-knot current caused the Martinez to drift to the north. Luckily, the engines on the Martinez were running at the time, and the 600-foot oil tanker was able to slowly pull ahead, relieving the pressure on the line. Personnel from the Tesoro tank farm soon responded and were able to shut down the flow of oil in about 15 minutes. No one was hurt in the incident and no oil was spilled, but it was, according to Tesoro's own investigation, a very close call.
Our position is this is Russian roulette, and we continue to load the gun here.
That's Bob Shavelson from environmental watchdog group Cook Inlet Keeper. Shavelson first heard about the incident from whistleblowers who witnessed it, and Cook Inlet Keeper, along with KBBI, came into possession of the investigation report after Tesoro reported its findings to the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, or CIRCAC, on March 30th. CIRCAC receives its funding directly from the oil industry. Jerry Rombach is director of public outreach for CIRCAC. He disputes the level of danger that occurred during the Martinez tanker incident in January, pointing out that the ship was under its own power the whole time.
Had the Martinez not had power or lost power, we'd have an altogether different story to be saying, but because of the precautions that the company took, there was really no danger of any real incident.
When asked why a report on the incident had not found its way into the public eye for more than 2 months, Rombach said such reports usually only go to the Coast Guard and state agencies like the Department of Environmental Conservation. Rombach says that Tesoro employees followed all the protocols for what's called Phase 2 ice conditions for Lower Cook Inlet. According to the official Coast Guard operating procedures, activation of Phase 2 measures is based on a number of factors, including severe subfreezing temperatures, aerial ice observations, and forecast information from NOAA. When Phase 2 measures are put into place, as they were on the night of the Martinez incident, crews are supposed to discontinue all transfer operations, prepare the transfer hoses to be disconnected, and position a designated vessel near the moored vessel to act as an ice scout. All of that did indeed occur, according to Rombach and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. John Catula is Marine Vessels Section Manager for DEC. He says the state did not fine Tesoro over the Martinez incident, but it did issue the company a notice of violation.
Tesoro did a pretty thorough analysis of everything that took place, and they did come up with a lot of corrective actions, and we required them to do a thorough investigation of all of the events that led up to this particular situation.
Bob Shavelson, however, is not convinced.
We had the onset of heavy ice very early in Cook Inlet. You would think that an operator at a dock that has had a long history of problems would make sure that everybody knew exactly what the protocol was. It's problematic in light of the long history of casualties we've seen around marine navigation in Cook Inlet.
In an email message, Tina Barbee of Tesoro Media Relations said that there were, quote, no environmental impacts and no injuries, and we've made process improvements to ensure this kind of event does not occur in the future. Phase 2 ice conditions were lifted for Cook Inlet March 29th on the orders of Coast Guard Captain J.A. Fosdick, the captain of the port for Western Alaska. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
The Coast Guard is watching for fuel and debris from a derelict Japanese fishing vessel. It sank off the coast of southeast Alaska on Thursday. Kip Wadlow of the agency's public affairs office says nothing of significance has been found so far. A small sheen was spotted Thursday, but was expected to dissipate quickly. Wadlow says the Petersburg-based cutter Anacapa began firing at approximately 1 p.m. yesterday. The Ryun Maru went down at 6:15 p.m. in about 6,000 feet of water.
When the ship started to sink, the starboard quarter, or the right backside, went in the water first, and then the ship just slowly rolled over and sank.
The 200-foot vessel was washed out to sea by last year's Japanese tsunami. It crossed into the Pacific Ocean without crew or power, then drifted up the coast of British Columbia into Alaska waters. Wadlow says the Coast Guard fired 440 rounds of explosive ordnance at the ship's waterline. The ship was about 180 miles west of Sitka when it sank, and it's not clear how many pollutants it had on board. The Coast Guard does not believe it contained any radiation. An agency C-130 aircraft is flying a grid over the area to check for oil or debris.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time home buyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm BD Trantina. This week on AK, getting ready for spring. Outside in most of Alaska, it still looks a lot like winter. But a true harbinger of the coming warm season has announced itself in the northern interior community of Eagle.
There was a small flock of snow buntings cruising around, and that's a sign that spring is coming.
That's longtime Eagle resident John Borg. He's collected annual climate data in his community for the National Weather Service for the past 35 years. The snow buntings return to their high Arctic breeding grounds beginning in early April. As Emily Schwing reports, a whole host of other bird species follow close behind, announcing the arrival of spring across the state.
At Creamers Field in Fairbanks, snowplows suck and blow snow from a field in anticipation of the Canada geese that are on their way from Delta Junction. That's roughly 80 miles to the southeast as the goose flies. Lori Beck is a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
They're about on time. The average is around between the 9th and the 13th. So since 1976, we've been collecting the data.
Creamers Field is the site of an old dairy farm, which was established at the turn of the century when three cows and a handful of horses arrived from Nome by steam wheeler. In 1928, the Creamers family purchased the land and operated the largest dairy in interior Alaska for the next 40 years. The state purchased and expanded the dairy, establishing a 2,000-acre bird refuge in the late 1970s. Fish and Game has managed it ever since. Despite the change in hands, Lori Beck says migratory birds have stopped over at Creamers since the fields were first plowed a century ago.
They've always come through. It's part of the Pacific Flyway. And so when the birds come up north, you know, they just kind of follow along the same path as they head out to their breeding grounds. And so we've always been part of their path.
A handful of onlookers in parked cars and trucks stare at the massive cloud of snow that's kicked up by the industrial-sized snowblower. It's hard to tell if they're patiently awaiting the geese or if they're puzzling over what looks like the off-road version of a Zamboni. It's a long-standing Fairbanks tradition to look up for Canada geese this time of year. And interior Alaska isn't the only part of the state patiently awaiting the annual bird migration.
Well, sandhill cranes are just, somewhat the charismatic megafauna of birds.
That's Nina Faust. She founded Kachemak Crane Watch in Homer over a decade ago. The group works to protect cranes and their habitat.
They've been harbingers of spring, which everybody around here really looks forward to.
And this year, Faust has her eyes peeled, scanning the sky over Kachemak Bay for one bird in particular.
Well, actually, you know, the raging story around here has been the goose who's been hanging out with the sandhill cranes.
She says a group in California affectionately named him the Lesser Canada Goose, Homer.
Last year, we kept getting reports from all over Homer. What's with this goose? Everywhere this flock goes, this goose shows up with them, and he hangs right in the middle of the group. He fights with them. He pays attention to their signals. If there's an alert call from the cranes, he stands up, and they fly off. He flies off with them.
Faust took video of the birds grazing together last summer and shared it on YouTube. Biologists have told Faust his egg was probably laid in a crane's nest. When he hatched, he may have imprinted on his leggier counterparts. Faust says he doesn't seem to notice.
So nobody knows where he's been and everybody's anticipating. Is he going to come back and will we see him this summer?
Most of the birds who come north don't stay in any one place for the entire season. Lori Beck says those that stop to snack at Creamers Field head further north.
A lot of the birds will actually head to Tanana Flats in order to mate. Some of them will actually head north to the Yukon Delta, and the rest of them will head to Minto Flats.
Beck is also patiently awaiting a particular bird.
The white-fronted goose, yeah, they're my favorite. They're the ones, they have the bright orange feet and the pink bills, and they just have this great laugh to them. And they're also called speckle bellies. They're pretty fun.
Whatever your bird of choice, they're on their way, bringing spring along with them. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're on our way to Women's Bay in Kodiak Island. The community was named by a Russian explorer in the 1700s.
I am Marie Rice, and we live in Women's Bay. Bill's Flats is the other name we're called in Kodiak.
Dale Rice.
We are
12 miles south of town.
Right, and there are three main bays along the road system, and Woman's Bay is the first one that you come to. It's past the Coast Guard Bays, and then there's Middle Bay and Calson Bay. It was called Woman's Bay because I've heard that it is where the native women, it's a calmer area where the native women could come and fish.
When Bronhoff was exploring the island when he first took over the colony, they paddled into the bay and the women were fishing, and he said it's Women's Bay.
We have larger acreage here per lot, and so we have big yards and less density, and people out here like it that way. And we have, over the last several years, had lots of bear visitors in late summer and down along the streams and along the ocean, and that's been exciting.
We have a lot of Coast Guard living out here on their tours up here. A lot of them join our volunteer fire department, are very active in things going on in the community. We've got several bed and breakfasts in the area, and access to fishing and bear viewing, and the emperor geese winter in the bay here by us, and they're a somewhat rare bird. So there's bird watching.
Much of the other areas toward town have dense spruce forest, and we have more open sunshine and with the beautiful mountains around us. It's where everyone wants to live.
Dale and Marie Rice live in Women's Bay on Kodiak Island. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK on Alaska News Nightly. We had help this week from Emily Schwing, Heather Arono, and David Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Bede Trantina.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Alexander Gutierrez in Unalaska, Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. And by Crowley, providing tanker support, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. cpdalaska.com. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.